this.
We know it doesn't matter. We know it doesn't matter. We know it doesn't matter.
A new world, the only preoccupation will be how to amuse itself. Tragedy of your time.
Time I'd ever even heard of this movie, that there even was a monkeys movie, was back in the 80s when Terry Garr was on the David Letterman show, and she talked about that she was in this movie, and Letterman seemed pretty flummoxed as to the movie's existence, and he started peppering her with questions about what this movie was, and she said the movie was called Head, and he was like, why is it called Head? And she said, well, the idea, as far as she knew, was when they did a sequel, they were going to use the tagline, from the people that gave you head. So that was the only thing I knew about this movie for a good, you know, additional 25 years. And never having been, you know, frankly, a huge Monkees fan, I watched them as a kid, but that I really, you know, that was pretty much it for me. I didn't have much interest in this movie. And then, David, you just would not shut up about it. So I finally watched the dang thing. And then I mentioned it on Twitter, and all of a sudden, all these people came out of the woodwork talking about how awesome this movie Head is. So, guys, please help explain this to me. Why is this movie so good?
Well, Greg, do you want to give your answer, and then I'll give the right answer? Or how do you want?
I think, at least for me, I think I just love the idea of how it just completely deconstructs the idea of this monkeys machine that had been going on for 2 years previous.
Right.
It was completely unlike anything that I had ever seen before. I saw it for the first time in 1987, and I had heard about this monkeys movie going through reading, you know, various books about the group, and I was just intrigued. And then when I finally got it as a birthday present, and I was just blown away by it. And and it still hasn't, and I still haven't recovered from the initial shock of it.
The reason I like it is actually the same reason. I mean, I think to find Head interesting, you have to appreciate what the monkeys were, and it, to me, it's always been the story of Head, of why Head was made the way it was made, is equally, if not more interesting than the movie to me. So I'm always looking for those I guess nuances of rationale within the movie.
I mean, to give some people some background, this movie came out right at the moment when the Monkees show was canceled. Is that right?
About six
yes.
months after.
Yeah.
Yeah, 6 months after. Wow. Okay.
The last episode, I think, was in like March of '68, and this came out in November of '68. At that point, the Monkees' popularity was starting to wane. They'd been on air for 2 years. They had released five albums, and just slowly, just through attrition, audience was aging out, learning about, you know, real rock groups at the time. And so this is kind of a last gasp at relevance, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting in that that's a good point, Greg, about the aging out, because they were a bubblegum pop group for the most part, and they were their core audience was teenage girls and young teenage girls, actually. They kind of were like pre-Beatle age kids.
They're the group that the younger sisters were listening to when their older sisters were listening to the Beatles and the like.
Right. So then their audience matures, kind of grows out of the Monkees, unfortunately, and then you're left with these four very different individuals, and the Monkey machine, the two guys behind the Monkees, who have kind of lost interest in the project themselves and are looking to really put it down, to euthanize the thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were ready to move on to other things. You know, Easy Rider is in their future.
Right. Yeah, because there's one guy in this movie you see for about 4 seconds who has a great deal of involvement behind the scenes, who will play a huge role in the lives of Raybert Productions.
Yeah, I mean, this movie has an amazing pedigree. It's directed by Bob Rafelson and written by Bob Rafelson and somebody named Jack Nicholson.
Yeah,
and that
in itself is a big contention, right? So, so the way this movie was written was Rafelson, Bert Snyder, who's the other creative head behind the Monkees, Nicholson, the four Monkees themselves, and there's another person whose name I'm blanking on, who was sort of their de facto manager at that point.
Yeah, their manager. I can't remember his name either.
So they all went up to Ojai, which is along the coast of I guess really central California. Did a lot of pot for a weekend, and just
talked into a microphone.
Yeah, they just really farted into it for two days straight. And Nicholson just supposedly just pulled all these different elements out of that, and then from there he and the director put the story together. But then come the actual first day of shooting, the Monkees want screenwriting credit, and they go on strike that first day. Well, all but Peter Tork, who was actually kind of friends with Rafelson, and Rafelson just ends up shooting footage with body doubles for an entire day before the Monkees settle for
points
they get a piece of the action, a piece of the movie's action, not knowing, of course, that the movie's going to be a dismal failure, but that's how that got settled.
I mean, what? Okay. All right. I mean, for
what's wrong, Rob?
I'm trying to get a hold on this movie. Because, all right, let's talk about the cast a little bit. I mean, obviously, the Monkees themselves are in this. Tork, J.V. Jones, Mickey Jones, Michael Nesmith. But we've also got Victor Mature as the Big Victor. Annette Funicello. Gonzo character actor Timothy Carey. Vito Scotti. And then a bunch of other kind of smaller people that come in and out. I mean, this movie is...
Frank Zappa, yeah.
This movie is intentionally plotless. I mean, it opens up with the Monkees.
But it isn't.
Explain it to me. That's why you guys are here. Explain this to me. Because this movie left me completely baffled.
If you listen to Bob Rafelson, if you trust Bob Rafelson, this movie was all about boxes and reflection, and about a deconstruction of media, and it was supposed to have kind of an avant-garde thing going to as well. The theme of boxes does repeat throughout the movie, and the theme of constructed beings. They keep driving home this notion of dummies, right? There's the I'm the dummy scene. There's dummies being torn apart in that. Oh God, we gotta talk about Circle Sky. But when the dummies are being torn apart, the dummies that were the Monkees
going off the bridge.
Right. That's right. Obviously dummies. And then there was the one at the factory whose head just falls off and Davey's the only one who notices. So it's
the one out of the closet. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And the closet. So it's just a complete, it's sort of up to my butt a lot of the times. And, I'm not going to say that it's not pretentious at all, cause it kind of is, but there is supposed to be a theme there.
They try to go outside of, you know, explore their own thing, and they keep getting pushed back into that box.
Right, and at the end scene is there's no matter what they do, it's a Mobius strip, and they're going to be stuck in that box forever.
And to a certain extent, that happened even after the Monkees' experience, because they went out and did their own solo things, and then every 20 years or so, they get pulled back into the machine.
Right. And then, yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this is the last time they kind of had any creative input in anything that they were going to do as this unit of four up until 1997. They did this special called The Monkees 33 and a Third. It was a television special, which is if you did Head, but with Sid and Marty Krofft. Money and sort of.
Wow.
It is the Star Wars life day of monkey stuff. And that's not being.
That's probably the best description I've ever heard of that. I mean,
is it great music in it?
It's
wretched.
Okay. Weird. And a friend of mine loves this thing, and I don't understand. He says it's the most brilliant thing they've ever put together.
I don't see that. And I would say my reaction to 33 and a Third Revolutions was completely the opposite of Head.
Yeah, because Head is like, I could watch this countless times, and I kind of have. But 33 and a Third, I will never, I have a very hard time with that. Plus, it's the last time the four of them are together for over 20 years after that, or almost 20 years after that. So, so Victor Mature is also kind of the key person in the movie because they live in his head. He also is sort of...
He represents old Hollywood.
Right. He manifests himself as the guy who's controlling what you see, as well as being the thing that you see. And he occasionally drives a narrative, and I mean that very loosely. But he does have a big part in it. He's, you know, it's all in Victor Mature's head. And do you know how Victor Mature came about? You know about this, right, Greg? Why Victor Mature, of all things?
No, actually, I don't.
Because they were... I think Rafelson, well, they were all just stoned out of their mind. And Rafelson thought of the blackest thing that he could, and he thought of Victor Mature's hair. And so that just led to this whole outgrowth of things. And even though he
was in the script,
they never... Yes, which is the closest you get to the series in many ways. So they wanted Mature for the role, but nobody would reach out to him because nobody... He thought that he would do it. So Nesmith just took it upon himself to call Mature, and then Mature agreed to do the movie.
Wow, I did not know this.
The blackest thing you could think of, Victor Mature's hair. He's great. He's like a giant imp.
Yeah, on IMDb it says the whole reason that he, according to him, the whole reason he did the movie, he said he didn't make any sense, but all I know is it makes me laugh. That's why he said
he is chuckling through the whole thing.
Huh. Oh, yeah.
I guess the thing that I had an issue with as I watched this movie was like
the stuff film?
No. It's just that like I feel like where the monkeys. I mean, I don't ever want to tell any creative person don't do this, don't do X, because you know, do whatever you want, you know. But at the same time,
sometimes that's good to say. Paul McCartney needs to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, like you know, Chris Gaines or something like that. But I mean, it just felt like when I watched this movie, it felt very pretentious. It felt very self-pitying, like, oh, we're the poor famous, oh god, everything sucks, we're just this or whatever. And it's like, you guys are the monkeys, like, let's kind of get over yourselves a little. That was sort of the read I had on it, and that's why it kind of left me with a weird, like, you guys are, frankly, I'm sorry, you're not the Beatles, you know. I think
at this point that they were ready to be done with it.
Pete, in this movie
pretty much, you know, this is, they realized they probably only had this one shot, and they were going to probably blow up the entire concept, so might as well go out with every type of film possible. It's a war movie. It's a desert film war movie.
I never got the feeling they knew what they were doing in this movie as they were making it, even though they suggested ideas. And a lot of it might just be sort of retroactive history, but they're retelling their story the way they want to tell it. But like Jones regrets that it wasn't a movie that their audience could actually see and appreciate. I know Torque is sort of baffled by it. Nesmith seems to be the only one that really likes it.
What a shock.
How dare you?
He probably was ready to be done with it.
Two albums ago.
Exactly. He's writing out his contract. The whole thing about, you know, they say that we're plastic. Wait till I tell you how it was done. I mean, that's pretty telling that he's ready to move on to the next thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's such a, it like his versions of this monkey story is so interesting and oftentimes contradictory, I think, to anyway. In many ways it was supposed to be sort of the nail in the coffin, which is very strange because they still had something like four more albums that they that people put out under the monkey's banner, even though they would start to whittle themselves down into two final members within a couple of years after this.
Yeah, the next one only had the three of them in it, without Torque.
Right, it was sort of like a, like, yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think he played on anything, right? No, he didn't. He was still credited. I don't think he, yeah, he was done.
I think Instant Replay was their next album, and he wasn't part of that one after Head, I think. I could be mistaken.
Was it Birds and the Bees before this?
Yeah, after it was this, before, I mean? This.
Oh, was it? Okay, so yeah, so then it was, that's right, Instant Replay presents, and then you get to Changes, which is just two, Dolan's and Jones. And interestingly enough, this movie was supposed to be
called Changes
before it ended up getting called Head. And the album, the soundtrack, or the accompanying album, was supposed to have a reflective surface. So when you buy it, and you look at, you're going to see yourself. And in typical fashion for this movie, that didn't work out very well, and that the plants that were pressing the albums had to do it all by hand because the whatever the material they were using for the records was wrecking the assembly line.
All right, I'm hearing you guys discuss all this, and I'm kind of figuring, like, what was it because they had no control over their career? Because it's like, I hear this, I'm like, why were they so miserable? Why was it because they were just pushed from thing to thing, and they didn't, unlike the Beatles, they didn't have any real control over what they were doing? Is that
why? Here's the thing. It's they were hired to do a job, right? They were hired to become a monkey,
right?
So there's no organic pull toward these four individuals becoming a band. The band
was the prefab four, right?
But they are magic together. Am I wrong, Greg?
Oh, isn't no, this, you're not wrong at all.
They are wonderful. This is this is the Voltron of groups to me. You know what I mean? It shouldn't work, but goddamn it does.
It's like unlike anything that I had seen up to that point. I mean, just talking about the TV show, but
yeah. Oh, well, that TV show is brilliant. But yeah, so because you have to look at it this way. So Davey, he was a Broadway guy, essentially, who's under contract. Dolan's was already an actor who kind of left the business. He was a kid actor. He was in a band at the time called The Missing Links, oddly enough. He was in a band who fired him right before he got his Monkees gig. Joke's on them. And then Nesmith was already signed to a record deal as Michael Blessing and had sold some songs and was brought on. And then Torque was friends with Stephen Stills, who recommended him for this gig. And Torque already knew like four or five instruments, so he was brought on. But they were never supposed to be a band. They were supposed to pretend to be one. And it just turns out you had these four. You had one really strong ego in Nesmith who wanted this to become he wanted his music. Like he wanted his band. He didn't want the Monkees, really. You had Torque, who wanted to do music, who fell into this acting thing. Turns out he's pretty good at it. And then he's the one that
I appreciate the most, actually, right, in this movie.
Isn't it hard to play stupid? He's so smart, and he has to play an idiot every day. And he does it superbly.
Brilliantly. Yeah.
Go on.
I was going to say, when I first discovered the Monkees, Peter may have been my least favorite, but as I've gotten older, he's at the top of the four for me, and particularly
Same. He's not my favorite monkey, but he's up there. He's at least he's tied for first, maybe. But and then you have Jones, who's a contract guy who was very obsessed with money at some point. And then you have Dolan's, who was happy to have a job, found himself in a world that he doesn't really like. He has no sense of how this is going to work. You don't have Beatlemania and really understand it, and then you have a Monkees mania, and you don't understand that, and you're at the heart of this thing. So you're going to have these four very strong egos. One of them is super strong. Eventually, you get all these. There's infighting between the four of them. Not all four of them like each other.
Particularly Torque and Jones.
Well, not only that, but Nesmith and Torque. Not a lot of love lost, from what I've heard over the. During those years, but so you have these four people that don't really know what they're doing, but they know they maybe want to do something else. And
I think at this point they're also tired.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They had that. Their shooting schedule was crazy.
Exactly.
And they're doing live shows too.
So from like 1965 onward, so up until 1968 or so, yeah, they're going nonstop.
Right. But then they have these golden handcuffs, and this job pays really, really well. Really well. So they're able to do things that they were never able to do. Davy Jones was able to buy his dad a house. You know, Mickey Nesmith, Mike Nesmith was Mike Nesmith, who was already Mike Nesmith is interesting because he was already on the way to a good fortune and knew it. So he could take more chances than the other guys with this thing. When he comes out and says, by the way, all this is fake. We don't you don't hear us on these albums. You don't hear us playing instruments on these albums. He took it upon himself to dispel the myth of the monkeys without ever consulting the other three guys. So he did it in a Saturday Morning Post interview or something like that.
Yeah.
Or Saturday
Evening Post. Yeah.
Saturday Evening Post. Thank you. So you have these guys that all want different things, and Jones was perfectly happy to let this thing go on. I think Dolan's was too, but the other two were becoming less and less into it, and then you have Head.
They were musicians, and they were chomping at the bit to actually, you know, be in more control of their musical career.
Right, and then as for Rafelson and Schneider, they were done. Like, these guys were pains in the asses too, because they'd gone through this whole thing with wrestling the music from Don Schneider, Don Kirshner. Thank you, Don Kirshner, wrestling music and musical control of their group from him. So now these guys are becoming, they have their own egos, and it's, yeah. So if you want to control your own production, this is a great way to end it. A great way to end it. So that's why this movie's so interesting to me, because this is supposed to be a nail in a coffin, but the corpse refuses to die in Bela Lugosi fashion, and Bela Lugosi is in this movie.
And so is Tor Johnson. This is his last film, which is sort of baffling to me, the Tor Johnson. Yeah, I mean, like I said,
it's a step up from Ed Wood. Thank you.
Yes, that's true. Like I said, I found this movie impenetrable and a little kind of like, kind of a slog to get through. At the same time, I admired their willingness to kind of, as you said, put the nail in the coffin, like to just say, all right, we're gonna blow this up. Like, that takes guts to do. And to do it via a giant movie, you know?
Right.
That's pretty,
that nobody
pretty
sees.
Gutsy.
And it's so weird because you have one of the greatest musical performances you will ever have from them. Captured in
the circle sky.
Yes, so beautiful. As Nesmith puts it, like, he looked around and realized, holy shit, we're a band. Like, look at this.
It is incredible to watch.
Yeah.
Even without the intercuts from all the Vietnam footage,
I could have done without that. Somehow this has a G rating. But I could have done without the cuts.
Yeah, the more I watch it, the less thrilled. The gimmick of the intercutting with the Vietnam stuff is less interesting to me as I go along, but it's just one of those things. As I said, the first time that I saw it, it was just like, oh my god. And even more interesting that's like brand new footage,
right,
at that time.
Right. It was world famous, brand new. Yeah. So that was Rafelson saying that look how we can manipulate your emotions, because here's a girl, teenage girl, screaming, but we're intersplicing it with something that's exciting, and yet Here's what's being shown on the news, and so
it's all punctuated in the Swami's speech at the end about being unable to differentiate between the real and the vividly imagined experience.
Right, right. But then they kind of comment on that by having it all be like this. It's all just smoke. You know what I mean? So it's all steam. It's all this ethereal kind of nonsense at the same time. But yeah, so there's a lot going on. I think this is one of those movies where its parts are greater than its sum sometimes. But does that make sense?
Yeah, I kind of agree with that.
And I figured you would love Peter Tork because he's dressed like Aquaman at one point.
It takes a little more than that for me to like a movie. I mean,
blonde, orange shirt, green pants.
Okay.
What does that sound like?
Yeah, I get it.
The mermaid.
I got it. Like I said, I'm kind of willing to revisit it because you guys were such devoted, you know, fans of it when I mentioned it, and you know, I've looked it up and I've talked about that there is a real cult, you know, love for this movie now. And you know, again, anything that's written by Jack Nicholson and Bob Ravelson is like, okay, that's got something going on to it. It's clearly not. And, you know, I can appreciate, I mean, I remember, it's funny, the thing I think about when I watched this movie was I went and saw Punch Drunk Love in the theater back when that came out. And I clearly, I was with my friend, and we saw it because we love Paul Thomas Anderson. And we saw it, and about 20 to 30 minutes into the movie, you could see all the bros in the audience get disgusted and walk out. Because they were expecting Adam Sandler to do Adam Sandler. They were not right. expecting this artsy thing where it was uncomfortable and whatever. And I remember thinking, that's really gutsy of Adam Sandler to purposely do something that his audience does not want and will and completely rejects in every way. That takes a lot of guts. And so I kind of think of the monkeys. I'm like, okay, you know, yeah, they probably could have milked it even longer. I mean, that's how big they were and how big the coattails of the Beatles were in terms of, like, everything around them. But, you know, like, I'm still kind of weird, dubious on the movie exactly, but you guys' enthusiasm for it makes me, you know, a little less harsh than when it was when I first saw it. Because it's like,
well, it's,
yeah.
it's part of the monkeys' canon. You know, it's like, okay, you have friends that are Superman fans, right? Myself included. Very forgiving of Superman 3. You know what I mean?
True. That's true.
The layperson, probably like, why are you watching this? Is this what you're into? That's what
yeah.
you get, right?
Yes. Thanks, Mom.
To a normal person, but to somebody who loves this thing called the monkeys, this is a very interesting sort of side project. This is like the experimental album, or you know what I mean, or the concept album or something.
This is that Lou Reed album that was all metal music, all just like
yeah.
grinding metal. Okay,
it's an
they're
interesting...
the one that only dogs can hear. Yeah,
yeah.
It's an interesting third choice that you make if you're gonna make a movie and you don't want to make a straight up adaptation of your television show like. The Batman movie is
right.
You don't want to make a concert film, so
oh, I would have killed for that though. But yeah, so they make this, and it's interesting because what makes them so good is the group dynamic that they have when they're together. Whenever it's the four of them on the television show, especially the second season when they're kind of just there's really no script at times, or so they say. They're wonderful together, and you don't really get that in this movie, which is sad.
It's a quiet film is something that I kind of reflect upon as I, you know, saw it the last time I watched it.
It is. No, that's true. And what the one thing I forgot to mention was Rifelson said that he didn't know if he was ever going to make a movie again. So he said he wanted to put in every kind of movie he wanted to make in this one movie. So he kitchen synced it, right? So you have the war stuff, the romance. You have this incredible dance scene. I'm surprised you didn't talk about this, Rob. This amazing scene with Tony Basil. With Davy Jones, just brilliantly cut and shot, and just a beautiful Harry Nilsson song. Well, that's redundant, but just a Harry Nilsson song. That it's a breathtaking little sequence.
It is, and Davy does such a great job with it. He does it great twice.
Twice. It's magnificent.
I'm always, you know, however, I'm a little intrigued with the Michael Nesmith version of that scene might have been because he really wanted to do that scene.
He did. He even did the song. He did a version. There's a version of the song that had with his vocals on it. But
I like that one a little bit more than the final one. But your mileage may vary.
Right, but the scene itself is just wonderful. I mean, it's because that is typical. That is Davy Jones. That's who he is. He's a Broadway rock guy, and. He's by no means my favorite. I don't know. I have to add that. But this is it. One of his best performances is in this movie. One of his best.
I will.
And
say
one of Mickey's best performances.
Who's your guy's favorite monkey then?
Oh,
well, if I were
this
to,
is hard.
Actually, Nesmith is my favorite. He's always been my favorite.
That's interesting.
Torque, my second. Dolan's and then Jones, if I were to rank them.
Yeah, see, he's not my favorite. See, because I love Mickey's singing voice. I know you don't, Rob. But I love Mickey, and I think he's the guy, like, he's the glue for that band and the show. Not so much in the movie, although he's exceptional in the movie when he's fighting the Coke machine.
Oh, yeah, the Coke machine.
Such
just
a
that
great
expression,
bit of acting.
That expression.
Such a good actor.
The expression on his face when he blows it up.
Yeah.
that after he tells the disembodied voice to shut up, those reactions are just awesome.
Yeah, oh, he's such a good actor. So I think he's my favorite because he's the most physical of them all. If you ever look at the show, he carries that thing most of the time. I mean, because Nesmith's allowed to just be like almost ambivalent most of the time. You know what I mean?
I guess I like that attitude, so that's the reason.
No, I do too. I do too, and I try to emulate that when I was younger. I couldn't, but I think it has to be Mickey. But kind of tied with Torque because he's playing dumb, and he's playing naive, but he's not.
I think.
And then
he was my least favorite for a long time, but he's raising just because I appreciate the fact that he isn't this dummy, and just the way he plays it makes me appreciate his performance a whole lot more.
But he's my favorite musician. Nesmith is my favorite musician of the four. And then Jones. And it's sad that Jones was the only one that I sort of met out of the three. I mean, out of the four. When he's not... Did I ever tell you my Davy Jones story?
No, I didn't know you ever met him.
Kinda. Okay. It's really embarrassing. So cut it if you want, because there's going to be some language here. But so it's 1998, and I just moved here from Texas, and I'm coming down the stairs of the apartment I'm sharing, and who do I see in the lobby but Davy Jones? My best friend points him out to me and says, "David, that's Davy Jones." And I look and I said, "No, it's..." I said, "Holy shit, it's Davy Jones."
Wow.
And out of my mouth I hear, "Holy shit, you're that fucking monkey." And I start running at him, and his eyes go wide, and I'm yelling, "Don't run from me, monkey. Davy, I'm not going to fuck you up. I swear to God, don't run from me. Stop." And of course, he runs off and I never see him again.
What?
And I stop like, yeah, I was so excited. I was overcome by this. I would grow up in Texas. We didn't see, you don't see your teenage idol. You know what I mean? You don't see that. Then all of a sudden, Davy Jones is in the lobby and I chase him off because I'm weird.
Oh my God, wow.
Yeah, that's better than my Davy Jones story.
Let's hear yours.
Oh, there's not much to it. I mean, he had written that autobiography, "They Made a Monkey Out of Me." And, I stood in line to get his autograph when he came into town. And, you know, I made some comment to me and was just real dismissive about it when I had him autograph the book. And it was like, oh. Maybe in hindsight, he had a whole line of people to sign. But that was, it wasn't exactly the wonderful, brilliant moment that I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, because he's sad. These stories.
I'll tell you the Halle Berry one day, and it's even sadder.
When we get to a Halle Berry.
We'll do Catwoman. But
no, we won't.
But no, sorry. But no, if you want to talk about the soundtrack really quickly, it's pretty good with the exception of Circle Sky, which is not the version you see in the movie. They remixed it.
Yeah, which was a point of contention, too.
Right. From the other guys, they said, why... Actually, three of the Monkees guys were like, "Why is it like this? This is shit. It's supposed to sound like it did in the movie." And Nesmith says, "I don't know." And then kind of walks away from it. Well, this is really his, like, a crowning achievement of his, I think. But, yeah, if you want the good live version, you have to go to Music Box, or I think it's on one of the Missing Links albums.
Uh-huh. You can find it, but yeah, it was disappointing because I'd got the soundtrack before I'd seen the movie and was disappointed in retrospect.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you let Jack Nicholson put your soundtrack together.
Oh, that's true. I mean, which was another point of contention. I don't think they were particularly happy about Nicholson getting album coordinator credits on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, he really... And it's funny, like, this guy... Like, he landed a great gig, because when you look at Nicholson's career before this, it was just, like, Corbin stuff. And then all of a sudden, he hooks up with Grafelson, and then you get your Five Easy Pieces, you get your Easy Rider, and all of a sudden, that's what really begins what we know to be Jack Nicholson's career.
How did he hook up with the Monkees then? Like, how did that happen?
He met, I think it was either Grafelson or Schneider they would just encounter each other when they would see foreign films at a theater. And so because they were I think it was Rafelson, maybe it was Schneider, I can't remember, but he said that he was, you know, cheering at a foreign film, and there was only one other person in that particular screening who was doing the same thing, and it was Nicholson, and they struck up a conversation. And once they were started to do the movie, they were looking for someone to write it, and they couldn't think of who to do it, and they remembered this one guy who they knew that had written some movies for oh man, my brain is just locked up.
I'm trying to remember too, but yeah, he'd done some previous work, and then
How that came into be, and then they were friends, but they were friends of friends, essentially, is what it came down to, and then that relationship grew from there. And Nicholson loves this thing.
So much so, though, that Nicholson's girlfriend's in the movie. His girlfriend at the time is in the movie.
I will say that scene with Nicholson's girlfriend, I found out where she walks and kisses all four of the monkeys in one long shot. That's a pretty potent scene. Like, I remember when I saw that, I was like, "Wow, that like
rated G."
Yeah,
rated G.
That's a pretty... that
Can You Dig It scene. You know the woman who's prominently featured in the Can You Dig It scene, the dance scene. She goes on to be, I guess, sort of famous. She's on the cover of an Art Garfunkel album.
Yeah.
The big solo one he did. Anyway. So yeah, so there's another tie. Everything comes back to the monkeys. Here's the thing: you have to, I think, really to like the movie, you have to like the monkeys. Otherwise, as a standalone, who cares? It's really interesting. I mean,
if you're not a fan of the monkeys, you're not gonna want to invest the time in it.
86. And it's a really well made movie. I think. I mean. I think visually it's great. I think it's well put together. I think it's edited in a great, great way. I think it's shot beautifully for the most part. But yeah, the narrative push through it is very iffy if you're not into this thing.
I mean, I don't think I've seen an actual episode of the Monkees in since I was a kid. I watched them as a kid. They were part of my regular TV going lineup because Lord knows I didn't go outside. And, you know, so they were... It was, you know, Lost in Space and Star Trek and Batman and the Monkees and the whole bit. So, and I loved it. I loved the show, but it wasn't something I've kept up with.
Go ahead.
I will tell you, the thing that kind of killed the Monkees for me a little was I was working at a graphic design company, and it was just run out of a guy's house. And it was me and a buddy from... I know, David, I'm going to mention it, but a buddy from the Joe Kubert School. And
did you go to the Bob Dylan concert with this buddy?
I did. And so so he would, our boss would play, he had like 1,000 CDs, and he would play music, and we would listen, it was piped into our room in his house, and he was a big Monkees fan. And he had like the Monkees Deluxe box set, which, you know, had all the hits, and then all the rarities.
It's probably music box or something like that.
Maybe. And he played the rarities, and the rarities, like something called D.W. Washburn, which to me... To me, that is like the worst song ever recorded in the history. I was like, I got so enraged. I was like, Daydream Believer, I'm with you. And Last Train to Clarksville, okay. But then once it got into the B and C cuts, I was like, oh, what am I listening to?
That's not a D. How dare you? How dare you? That's a great song.
It's funny because I just had a conversation with one of my kids today about the Monkees. We were listening to a CD as we were driving to the library, and she wondered why I wasn't listening to their hits. And it's because at this point, I appreciate the hits. It's their B and C cuts that I appreciate the most. It's like, why aren't we listening to Last Train to Clarksville?
Yeah,
like,
if you get a hold of the, like, Nesmith did these Nashville sessions with a bunch of songs that ended up releasing as solo stuff. But yeah, I think that's around the instant replay time. But if you get a hold of those, I mean, those are the deep cuts, and those are brilliant, brilliant, brilliant.
And I will admit that you sent me a Michael Nesmith CD, and you sent me a Monkey CD, and there was some stuff in there that I genuinely really liked. You know, so I was
because they're a good band.
Okay. All right. Okay. This is a safe space. Don't worry. It's all right. We're fine.
It's going to be a smart space too, Rob.
For someone going into this movie, maybe the best way to like dip your toe into the pool would be like their last episode, The Froatiscaper.
Oh, which is brilliant. That's a Mickey Dolenz co-wrote and co-directed that. Or
interesting. Like that. I just learned that script came out of the same Ojai experience brought out head, because I was wondering about that, and because I kind of think of it as like a bizarre trilogy, is The Froatiscaper, Head, and then maybe 33 and a Third, but
right, and then that was it, We're the Monkeys,
yeah, We're the Monkeys special in 97.
Yeah, that was, and that, by the way, Rob, so that's all four of them in control of their entire destiny. Nesmith wrote and directed that thing, and that is also painful to watch.
Okay.
So, but yeah. And you know what? Interestingly, really quick, that kind of has the same feeling of Head as like, let's just kill this thing right now, because the conceit of that is the monkeys never left that home, in they never left their home in I think they were in Malibu, or in Santa Monica. They stayed there and grew up. They're now in their 40s or 50s, and they're still trying to make it as a band. And so they now go through the same sort of capers that they did in their 20s, only now in their middle age, as middle-agers, and it's just sad. And I think the only
thing I appreciate about that is the intercuts of the lizard sunning himself.
Yeah. And I mean, so if you ever look at Nesmith's, it's funny, because if you look at Nesmith's solo output, and I mean Elephant Parts, Television Parts, they're just as absurd as the stuff that he did with the monkeys and then in Head. So I think there was a lot of carryover. Like he took and used a lot more than he credits his past feature work with. So I think if you kind of like Head and you like the monkeys, you should seek out Elephant Parts and maybe just watch that 97 special, because it's all kind of the same type.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Okay. I'm
Monkey's cast coming soon.
I'm up for it.
You guys want to go do that show? You have a home for it here on the network, and it'll be perfectly fine.
I can't do anything. The Monkey's Pod.
There you go. Perfect name. Perfect name for it. So, well, all right. I am trying to expand my horizons and trying to appreciate this film in a different way. I did like the idea that it ends where it begins. I thought that was
brilliant,
that,
right?
That was a cool
Mobius
thing. Yeah. I like that a lot. The Mobius strip.
Well, it's in the song. It's in their Diddy Diego. It just tells you right up front what to expect.
That's right. It's layers, man.
Layers. All right. Well, that's...
As I said, I've seen this thing probably close to 30 times.
Wow.
And I find something new each and every time I watch this thing. Without exaggeration, this is up there as probably one of my favorite movies of all time.
You know, this was the first time, I think I've seen this five or six times. This is the first time that I noticed that all the soldiers in the beginning of the movie were black.
Oh, except for the one.
Yeah, except for the one. And then when they bring them back in the studio, when they're one of the many times they're running through the studio. I think this is the first time I thought, oh my God, this is another Vietnam thing, isn't it?
I love Nez's reaction as the rifles are spinning around.
Oh yeah, Torque's got some good ones too. Like he's anyway.
I've clearly lost hold of this podcast. So we're gonna wrap up our look at Head here. It's unfortunately kind of hard to find in terms of, it's not available for rent on iTunes or anything, but it is on DVD and Blu-ray from Criterion. Yeah. Of all people.
Well, there's two ways.
What did you say?
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube?
It's on YouTube.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, then you can watch it on YouTube. Okay. So, everybody's listening. If you haven't seen this movie and you're maybe would be interested in this kind of bizarro thing, I would say it's worth a gander, because it is gutsy. It is while I was not as receptive to it as maybe David wanted me to be, I was...
I just want us to be friends.
I appreciate that. We're not going to let a movie come between us, but it's fine. But if you can check it out on YouTube, and if you really like it, you can get the one with all the bells and whistles are from the Criterion. So, fellas, thank you for coming on to talk about this. I really...
Anytime.
Any monkeys.
Anytime. Anytime, monkeys.
All right, calm down. I knew that when I mentioned it just offhandedly on Twitter, and both you guys like exploded, and all of a sudden my phone was like, blink, 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 blink. And I'm like, wow, all right, these guys are really into this. So... Thank you for coming. David, thank you for coming back on the show. And Greg, thank you for coming on for the first time.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well,
thanks for giving us some head to talk about.
And that's the end of the show. So thanks. Thanks. And I mean the end of the show. We're not doing any more episodes. This is it. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Find the show on Twitter at Film and Water Pod. And you can find the show over the network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. Guys, where can people find you? Do you want to plug anything?
Greg, you go first.
You can find me on Twitter. I don't have any shows to push.
David.
You can find me on Twitter as well. And I, as I've told Rob, I'm sort of the wrecking crew of this network. I just show up and I bring the noise. Now, I also just had an article published on Emmys.com where I interviewed Rob Doherty of Elementary fame. So, yeah, look for me there.
Well, again, thanks very much, guys. I appreciate I like to learn new things, and I like the idea of having two mega fans on to talk about something that I'm only vaguely familiar with. So thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And until next week, that's a wrap.
What's up, Mike?
Oh, they're not anything up, Bugs.
It's nobody here but us monkeys.
So let's make some friends.
Hey, let's make some Kool-Aid.
Make friends with Kool-Aid. Make Kool-Aid with friends. Make friends with Kool-Aid. For a group that never ends. Make friends with Kool-Aid. Make Kool-Aid with friends. Make friends with Kool-Aid. For a group that never ends.
When you get crazy thirsty, have a glass of Kool-Aid. It's cool.
Make some Kool-Aid soft drink.
You can always use another friend.